can't afford to miss it. More distressingly, he has made a promise to Colonel Carlyle that he will ultimately break. He didn't lie, of course he didn't, but he knows that the Colonel took a different meaning from his answer than the one that was in his own mind when he spoke. "If this works, Stephen," the Colonel said, "if the children come, I want you to meet us at the South Gate as soon as it's safe to move. You can drive, Rosie, I assume." And yes, Greaves said, he could. He had read the manual and memorized it. He was confident that he could drive Rosie at need. While he was saying these things, obvious things, he prepared his answer to the bigger question. "If you make it, Colonel, and if I make it, then I'll meet you at the South Gate." He said it fiercely, forcing the words out of his mouth against the rebellion of his breath. The Colonel mistook his intensity for alarm. "You should be fine," he reassured Greaves. "They won't fire on Rosie unless they absolutely have to, and our coming out will mean they don't have to, or so they'll assume. We'll keep them talking until the children arrive, and after that they should have too much on their plates to worry about us." "Yes," Greaves agreed. "They'll have too much on their plates. Here." The Colonel gave him the tiny, handheld radio that used to be Dr. Fournier's. "This is on the Brigadier's frequency, so you can't use it to call us. Not yet. But once you get to the fence, if you don't find us, just keep this on and I'll talk you in." Then the Colonel left. And now he sits in the turret waiting and watching, knowing that he will never see the South Gate. He is lied by omission. It sits in his stomach like a stone. A voice from inside the lab, high but hoarse, scatters his thoughts. "Colonel? McQueen? Anyone?" Dr. Fournier has woken up and seems very angry. Perhaps that's not surprising, given that he was rendered unconscious by means of blunt instrument trauma, and now finds himself tied to the workbench. Greaves tries not to listen, even when Dr. Fournier demands shrilly and repeatedly to be let free, even when his shouting wakes the baby who starts to cry. Dr. Fournier is the other reason why Greaves is up in the turret. He is afraid of the doctor, and seriously needs to keep a safe distance in case the doctor goes from complaining and demanding to asking questions again. Last time that happened, the only thing that kept Greaves from giving up everything he knew was Rena knocking the doctor out with the heavy steel clamp stand. Rena isn't here now, so he has to be very careful. The fight outside has reached a crescendo. Greaves switches to the infrared goggles, which turn the bloodletting into an abstract play of shapes and colours. He bites his lower lip hard and tries not to think about punctured and perforated flesh, teeth and stones and bullets, blood running out onto the cracked asphalt. He hopes fervently that Rena and the others were able to get clear before the fighting started, that they're not out there in the middle of this killing field. The movement outside goes on for a long time. The screams and yells, the pleading and cursing likewise. A very long time. When the last of Fry's troops have been dispatched, the children move forward out of the brambles and the trees into the relative openness of the parade ground. They inspect the bodies, finishing off those who are still moving. Only then do they kneel down and feed. Perhaps it's Greaves's imagination, but he believes he can see the moment when the scarred girl, he has recognized her from her silhouette and from the way she moves, nods her permission. He wonders if she is looking for him among the dead, as he looked for her after the fire. He wonders what the captain's voice box told her that morning, assuming that she pulled the string and listened to the words. She wouldn't have understood them in any case. She doesn't speak the captain's language. These are pointless thoughts. It's time, he decides. He needs to go down. He assumes the children will come, in any case, to complete the errand that has brought them all this far, but just in case, he will meet them more than halfway. He descends from the turret. Greaves! Dr. Fournier bellows. Stephen flinches. I can see you there. Untie me. Untie me right now or you'll face a court-martial. We're under military law. I can order you shot. Steeling himself, Greaves enters the lab. He is shaking with terror, but he has a contingency plan. If Dr. Fournier asks him about the cure, or starts any sentence with a question word, then Greaves will sing the theme tune from Captain Power loudly enough to drown out the words. Dr. Fournier sags with relief as he sees Greaves. Thank you, he snarls with heavy sarcasm. Then he gasps out loud as Stephen walks right on past him. Greaves, stop what you're doing and loosen these straps. I'm warning you. He's the hero of the spaceways, the galactic engineer, Greaves tells himself. He doesn't say it aloud, but he's ready to. At a moment's notice, if a single dangerous word comes out of Dr. Fournier's mouth. He keeps his face averted as he fills a canteen with water and loops its strap over his shoulders. As he opens freezer compartment 10 and removes the dead boy. Then, as he sets the cold corpse down on the work table a few inches from Fournier's head, Fournier pulls back from it with a yelp of protest. I'm warning you, it's tautologous, Greaves says. He almost shouts it, his strained voice rising in pitch. This is the most dangerous moment, with the feral child actually in Dr. Fournier's line of sight, a visual cue for the forbidden topic. What? Dr. Fournier splutters. To say you're warning somebody is to perform a self-enacting speech act. The warning is contained in the words used to announce that a warning is being given. He's babbling, pushing the conversation like a boulder away from the place where it mustn't go. Greaves, are you mad? The doctor's face is darkened to a deep red, almost purple. Perhaps he is. There would be no way of knowing, which of course is always the problem, not just for him, but for everyone. Sanity is a suspended state, moored in nothing but itself. You test the ground an inch in front of you, move forward as though it's solid. But the whole world is in free fall, and you're in free fall with it. I don't know, Greaves admits. I just don't know. He is staring at the small cadaver, guilty and desolate. The life that was here is long gone, but the dead boy's kindred have come a very long way to reclaim the part of him that they can still see. Greaves has disrespected that part. There are incisions and excavations where he took his tissue samples, raw wounds that had never bled, because the blood had already congealed before the flesh was broken. Greaves, Dr. Fournier's tone has changed. He is staring at Stephen with a new urgency. Put that specimen back. You hear me? It belongs to the expedition, and your findings, your discovery, all of it. The Colonel will be very angry with you if you do anything to jeopardize our mission, our joint mission. He'll be angry and disappointed. Why would you put at risk everything we've... Stephen slams the freezer cabinet shut and flees, taking the corpse with him. He's the hero of the spaceways! He yells. The galactic engineer! What? Greaves! Come back! The baby. The baby is next. Too many things, too many factors to keep straight in his head. He sets the dead boy down in the midsection just inside the airlock door. His hands are shaking. There is no sequence here. None of the things he is doing are in the long, long list of things he has done before. For a moment he is completely lost. In a panic he almost hits the airlock's controls. No, 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 not yet. Not yet. Dr. Fournier's cries follow him into the crew quarters. They echo around him as he goes to collect the baby from Rena's bunk. But the shrilling of the crying child is louder, and the pounding of his own blood seems louder still. It's easy now to shut out any meaning in the stream of sound coming from the lab. The baby is lying on his back, screaming, his mouth an O of hysterical misery. He's kicked his blanket away. Greaves picks him up and swaddles him again with ginger care. Miraculously and very suddenly, the baby stops crying at this point, as though human contact was all it wanted, as though all its sorrows came down to being alone. Perhaps that's true of everyone. "Soon," Stephen whispers, staring into the baby's solemn, inscrutable eyes. The blanket is green, like all the blankets in Rosie. Army issue. Greaves takes another from his own bunk, tugging it free one-handed with the baby cradled in his other arm. Dr. Fournier continues to yell through all of this, but baby Khan stays quiet. Nonetheless, he gapes his tiny mouth and tastes the air, which is no doubt rich with scents of possible food. Greaves notices that all the baby's teeth are now fully grown in. He goes back out into the midsection, carrying the baby in one hand and the spare blanket draped across his arm. Will it be enough? It's all he can do. He sets the baby down on the deck plates, making a nest out of the folded blanket to protect him a little against the cold metal. "I won't be long," he whispers. On the other side of the airlock doors, the night is impenetrably black. But through the infrareds, once he slips them on again, he sees a forest of bright blue lozenges converging on Rosie from all sides. Blue indicates a temperature between 10 and 14 degrees Celsius, barely higher than background ambient. The children are coming to meet him. "Greaves, I demand that you untie me. This is your last warning." Stephen hesitates for a long time. Finally, he goes back into the lab, opens one of the instrument drawers and finds a scalpel. He turns to face Dr. Fournier. The doctor tenses. He shrinks away as Stephen approaches, emitting a sound that's halfway between a whimper and a sigh. Stephen slips the scalpel carefully between Dr. Fournier's clenched fists. The doctor opens his hands and lets the scalpel drop, but then, on the second try, when he realizes that Stephen is not trying to murder him, he accepts it. "You can cut yourself free," Stephen tells him. "Probably. But you'd better not follow me, Dr. Fournier. It's not safe for you where I'm going." Fournier's eyes implore him. "Greaves, wait. Tell me. He's the hero of the spaceways, the galactic engineer. He brings the Terran code to all the planets far and near. For God's sake, Greaves!" But he's gone, still singing. Captain Power's ship was called Copernicus. He was a scientist as well as a hero, and knowledge was his greatest weapon. He would have hated Dr. Fournier, who tries to turn knowledge into things he wants. On the midsection platform, Stephen kneels and makes ready. He finds the scarred girl's totem, her gift to him, and slips his little finger through the ring. The smiling man in the red hat and blue overalls dangles between his fingers. He presses the airlock control. As the door slides open, he steps out. Into a mob. The children are everywhere, crowding dozens deep. So many. Have they brought reinforcements this time, or were they always an army rather than a family? But they are a family. The youngest press against the oldest or hide behind them, peeping out from cover. They grip onto the elbows of the bigger kids or swing from them, kicking their heels, as human children have always done. They are loved and protected, their place absolutely acknowledged. They make no move towards Greaves, perhaps having the door just slide open in front of them when they are gearing up for a siege throws them a little off their stride. He holds up the key ring for them to see and waits. He has no idea whether the little man with the M on his hat will make a difference, but once again it's all he's got. A ripple of interest goes through the children like a breeze through grass. They know whose sigil this is. Then something else goes through them. The scarred girl herself, striding confidently along a corridor that opens ahead of her and closes again in her wake. The children step out of her path quickly enough that she is able to maintain a steady pace, never having to slow or stop. She walks right to him. She extends her hand and touches the keyring with the tip of one finger, as though she is acknowledging a kinship or a debt. They exchanged gifts, she remembers. Stephen looks down at her waist, expecting to see Captain Power's voice box among the baubles hanging there, but it's not. When he looks up again, it's in her hand. He releases a held breath. He still has far to go, but he feels as though he is on the right road. Without shifting his ground, he half turns and points, raising his hand slowly and carefully behind him, towards the airlock, actually towards the midsection platform. He has left the lights on there so they can see. More gifts. Baby Khan lies on his back, quiet and good, kicking his legs just a little. Beside him, swathed in an identical green blanket, is the dead boy. It's not an equation. Greaves is not saying anything about their relative importance. He's just saying they're both yours. One living, one dead, but they're yours. See that. Two or three of the nearest children step forward, but the scarred girl stops them again with a single syllable. She is still looking at Stephen. She makes the exact same gesture he just made, points her finger at the living and the dead, then lets it fall. It's probably a status thing. He has to come to her. He has to bring his offerings and lay them down before her. He moves as slowly as he can, partly to avoid triggering any violent responses, and partly to maintain the sense that this is a ritual. He steps onto the platform and picks up the dead boy. The radio crackles in his pocket, speaks thin and broken words. Reluctantly, he sets the dead body down again, takes the radio out and puts it to his ear. Yes? Greaves, it's Colonel Carlyle. Greaves considers many possible answers, settles on one that he hopes will fend off profitless questions. I can't talk right now, Colonel. I'm busy. I know. I can see. I'm out on the parade ground, 50 yards away. If you close the airlock, I think I can disperse the children without harming them. Greaves is appalled. No! He yelps. Don't! Please, Colonel, don't do that! Don't fire on them! Then what support can I give you? Greaves looks out into the dark. He shakes his head in case the Colonel is actually close enough to see him. None, he says. Lad, you're going to get yourself... It's fine. I'll be fine. This is the only way, Colonel, the only way. Don't do anything. He hesitates. There's so much he can't explain, but maybe one thing that he has to... to keep the Colonel from running in with his rifle and ruining everything. But he's bad at explanations that aren't technical, and he is almost certain that the technical explanation won't work here. You know, he tries, with kittens, if they smell wrong or look wrong, sometimes the mother will eat them. What are you talking about? The Colonel asks. Rena's baby. He has to go to his people, Colonel. His people, but... For a few seconds there is nothing but static on the line. Then the Colonel's voice says, All right. I understand. Go on, Greaves. That's all, Greaves says. I want them to accept him. I promised Rena. And if I do everything right, it might be okay. But if you fire... Please don't, Colonel. Please don't do anything. Whatever you see. He switches the radio off and sets it down on the floor. Then he picks up the little corpse again and brings it out. The whole tribe is waiting in silence, taking their cue from the scarred girl. But a shiver of movement goes through them all when they see, or perhaps smell, what Greaves is carrying. One of the children speaks, a murmur of liquid syllables. Another makes a sound like a soft moan. The girl inclines her head and makes a brusque movement with her hand. She clicks her tongue. Four living children take the dead one from Stephen's hands and bear him to her. The scarred girl touches the boy's forehead and then her own. They lay him at her feet, as softly as if they were trying not to wake him. Stephen goes back inside, bends and scoops up baby Khan. The baby makes a small noise in his throat. Gah! His clenched fists paddle as though he's squaring up for a fight. Stephen raises him high as he descends from the platform again. He walks to where the scarred girl stands, in the midst of her people. He turns slowly, letting all of them see baby Khan and smell him. Moving as slowly and smoothly as he can, he goes down on one knee, then on both. He holds out the fragile bundle for the scarred girl to take. She examines baby Khan critically for the space of 2, 3, 4 heartbeats. She tucks Captain Power's voice box back into her belt. She takes the baby from him. With one hand she unwraps the blanket and casts it aside, almost with distaste. Her nostrils flare. The tableau holds for one heartbeat, and then another. Finally she speaks, a melodious stream of sounds with no consonants in it, no hidden rocks to break the flow. One of the other children, a boy older and taller than her, shrugs off a woolen shawl he is wearing as a sash and offers it up. The scarred girl takes it and swaddles the baby in it. She licks the tip of her thumb and anoints his forehead, very gently with her spit. A baptism. And since it's a baptism, Stephen takes the risk of speaking. "Sam," he says. He points to the baby, nods, smiles. "Sam." The boy who gave up his shawl goes to take up the fallen blanket, waste not, want not, but the scarred girl shakes her head and he backs away. Clearly there are boundaries here that matter. "Thank you," Stephen says. The girl answers him, but he doesn't understand her any more than she understood him. And now comes the hard part. He rolls up his sleeve, all the way to the elbow. Taking the canteen of water from his shoulder, he unscrews the cap and pours the water over his exposed forearm. He rubs the whole area with the palm of his other hand, wiping away the E-blocker gel that disguised his scent. He holds up his wrist, which now, he hopes, smells of all things that are good to eat. "Go ahead," he says. The scarred girl stares at him in perplexity. Her severe stare seems to ask a question. "Is this how we treat our friends?" "You have to," Stephen explains, knowing the words are futile. He is relying on her instincts, not her understanding. "Otherwise, when they ask me, I'll tell them that there's a cure. How to make it. Men with weapons will come after you, many, many more than are here now. They'll take you and turn you into medicine. Kill you all, just so they can have a few more years of life themselves. They won't even feel sorry about it." The scarred girl seems to listen. Her mouth is bent into a trembling gull-wing scowl, but she doesn't move. Greaves wonders how much control that takes, how much strength, and how much authority to make the others hold back, though they tilt their heads to catch the smell of him on the still air. The baby stirs and utters a thin wail of complaint, made suddenly aware of its hunger. Helpless, Stephen plunges on. "I can't kill myself. There are ways to do it without hurting, but it's not one of the things I can do. So we have to do this instead." He offers his arm again. The words are just a spur for his own faltering resolve. His dilemma would be almost impossible to explain, even if they spoke the same language. He needs her to wipe the hard drive of his mind, so he can't give her and her people up to the dubious mercy of their predecessors, Humanity 1.0. Part of this is the promise he made to Rena. "Keep him safe. It doesn't matter what happens to me, so long as you keep him safe." And that means keeping the whole tribe safe, which in turn means not letting out into the world the knowledge that will destroy them. but it goes beyond even that strict imperative. Greaves has been thinking it through ever since he first met the scarred girl and her people. On one of the lowest levels of his mind, in a subroutine set up for this alone, he has been working out the terms of the problem all this time. The solution is here, now. It takes the form of a Venn diagram, two circles intersecting. The world of Beacon, dying slowly every year, even before it decided to dismember and eat itself. And the world of these children, which, whatever it might be now, has at least the potential to be something else. It's a seed. A dead tree can stand for years or decades as it hollows out. A seed has places to be and things to do. Stephen has made up his mind. He's with the seeds, the scarred girls tribe. He can't be one of them, but he has chosen his allegiance. The children are all that matters. And right now, though he's on their side, he is the plague, the pathogen that could destroy them. The knowledge in his mind has to be safely disposed of. Please, he begs. The scarred girl makes a gesture. Her hand raised towards him, closed, and then open. She knows what he wants her to do. She won't do it. It's a complex problem with a simple, inelegant solution. Stephen extends his hand to touch baby Khan's forehead. Sam, he reminds them all. His name is Sam. He puts the tip of his thumb against the baby's lips. The baby's jaws work back and forth, sawing at Greaves's flesh. It's very hard for the tiny teeth to get a purchase, but once they do, they punch through his skin cleanly and quickly. They're very sharp. The baby takes its first meal. Stephen lets go of his humanity with much more relief than fear. It was an awkward burden to carry at the best of times. Chapter 61 The Colonel returns to Rosie across a field strewn with the bodies of the dead. All of the corpses he sees are adults and half-devoured. Brigadier Fry's troops seem to have given a poor account of themselves. Of course the children won the field, and therefore have had the opportunity to take their dead away with them. Certainly there's no sign of them now. Rosie's airlock still stands open, but the area around it is deserted. Carlyle is not surprised. He saw the moment when Stephen Greaves handed over Dr. Khan's baby, and the moment shortly after when, in a different sense, he surrendered himself. If Greaves was still present, Carlyle would shoot him just as he shot Samrina. Whatever the children are or may become, an adult human on exposure to cordyceps dies in that moment, or else becomes an unwilling passenger in a hijacked body. In the second case, the bullet is a mercy. In the first, it's probably an irrelevance, but it feels to the colonel like a mark of respect akin to covering the faces of the dead. But there is no sign of Greaves. Perhaps when the children melted away into the dark, he trailed along in their wake, moved by some half-remembered impulse. More likely he is out on the parade ground somewhere, feeding. The whoop, whoop, whoop of a helicopter's blades makes Carlyle look up to the sky momentarily. Sixsmith is hovering the little bird about 20 feet up, right above his head. She gestures, a thumbs up. She has her work to do and he has his. He waves back, wishing her and the others well. He hopes they will make it home. He hopes there will be a home for them to go back to. There is reason to hope. Brigadier Fry wouldn't have been out here in the wilderness making deals with the devil if her coup d'etat had been thriving. The little bird peels away. The last the colonel sees of it is the red light at the tail end of its fuselage, lifting into the sky like a stray spark from an extinguished bonfire. Carlyle is a practical man, and a soldier first and foremost. He enters Rosie via the cab, not the airlock, so that he can conduct a proper sweep from aft to stern. He finds no soldiers, no junkers, and no children. Nobody at all, in fact, except for Dr. Fournier, who was cowering in the lab with his hands still tied to the workbench. When the colonel enters, Fournier starts to babble out a stream of complaints, demands, pleas, questions and explanations, the words falling over each other in his haste to get them out. Carlyle checks the straps. They have been partially cut through, probably with the scalpel that is lying on the floor a little way away. But the doctor had not made much progress before he dropped the scalpel, and it bounced or rolled out of his reach. The straps will hold. When he sees that the colonel means to leave him there, Dr. Fournier switches tack and starts to threaten. He has friends in Beacon, friends with power and influence. He has been acting as Brigadier Fry's personal agent and representative. If he is harmed, if he is treated badly, the Brigadier will not be happy. Fry is dead, Carlyle tells him. If the doctor has any living friends, he would be curious to know their names. He puts the scalpel back in the instrument drawer where it will do no harm. In its place, he presses a full canteen of water into the doctor's hands. Whatever he eventually decides to do with Fournier, torturing him is not part of the plan. He goes aft to the cockpit. Along the way, he closes the airlock door. Driving Rosie isn't easy for a man with only one functional leg. There are a great many false starts before the colonel manages to get the vehicle turned around and moving away from the carnage. Then he wastes a great deal more time looking for the gate. Eventually, he gives up the search and rams straight through the fence, which offers no resistance at all. He is back on the M1 when dawn comes up, and by noon he is on the outskirts of London. When Hungries chase him, he does his best to outdistance them. Only as a last resort does he plough them under Rosie's wheels. He is looking for a place to stop, but not any particular place. He will not be returning to Beacon, and he has no wish for Rosie to go back there either. He liked her best as an instrument of truth, rather than a weapon of war. He will leave her somewhere where she is unlikely to be found by anyone in need of such a weapon, somewhere in the capital's endless labyrinth of streets. When the intransigent spike of the Senate House Library appears in the centre of the forward window, he knows he has reached his destination. He slows to a halt halfway along Mallet Street, on the exact spot to which the shadow of the library's spire points. He sits a while as the sun sinks down. The shadow swerves away from him, too slowly for him to see the movement, the hour hand of a clock, telling him his time is past. But clocks are not infallible. He goes and fetches Dr. Fournier, freeing him from the workbench but keeping him at the point of a gun. When they are both seated side by side in the cockpit, he explains what he is about to do. He does this as a courtesy. To see death coming and be able to look it in the face is part of what human beings gained when they took the path that led them away from the rest of the living kingdoms. Part of what they lost, too, no doubt. Distressed and terrified, Fournier pleads for his life. But he is indignant, too. He demands to know what he has done to deserve a sentence of death. "You conspired with Brigadier Fry to lead us into an ambush," Carlyle says. It seems best to him to keep this brief and simple. "We were meant to die there. You would have died too, but you didn't know that. You were willing to sacrifice the whole of Rosie's crew to your own purposes." Fournier's face flushes red, with anger rather than shame. "I was co-opted," he says. "Coerced. Nothing I did was by my own choice. Colonel, the Brigadier gave me a direct order, and she outranks you. You of all people have to understand." He falters, lacking the technical vocabulary. "The chain of command?" Carlyle supplies. "I do, Doctor. Very much so. I've always had what might be considered an exaggerated respect for it. But you're not a soldier, and you weren't bound to obey. You had the luxury of choosing for yourself where your duty lay."
"No, I didn't!"
Fournier is shrill.
"She told me the only way I would be appointed to the mission was if I agreed to do as she said."
"That," the colonel points out gently, "is what a choice looks like." He nods his head out of the window at the Senate House. "I was a student here," he says. "My degree was in history. I never imagined I'd live to see the end of it." Dr. Fournier starts to plead again. He says that with beacons split down the middle, he couldn't be said to have committed treason, only to have chosen the wrong side. Carlyle listens for a long while, then holds up a hand to stop the logorrheic flow. "Doctor, please. I was trying to explain, since you seem to feel you're being treated harshly. The point of history, the very essence of it as a field of study, is to find correspondences. You look at the past so that you can understand it, and through it, you come to a better understanding of your own time. If you're lucky, sometimes you can even extrapolate to possible futures." "I'm not a historian," Fournier points out. "No," Carlyle agrees, "but biology is about correspondences too, surely. You study living things to understand yourself." Fournier is looking at him now with wary calculation. "I suppose that's true," he says, with no conviction at all. "There's no need to humour me, Doctor. You're welcome to disagree, but it seems to me, am I wrong, that all living things form a sort of fractal pattern. The same features, the same structures, repeating themselves on different scales and in different configurations. You can't look at those things for long, surely, without finding yourself reflected in them." "I do," Fournier agrees fulsomely. "I find myself all the time." The colonel sighs. The man isn't listening to him at all. "Well, then," he says wearily. "Well, then what?" "Well, then you know what you betrayed. Not Beacon. Life. There were two sides, and you didn't choose life. Did you even look at that last set of samples? The ones we brought down from Ben McDewey?" Fournier's face is blank. "No, of course not. When would I have had time?" "Dr. Kahn found the time. I'm not sure whether it was before she gave birth or just after. She was surprised at what she found. None of the cordyceps cultures from Ben McDewey had germinated. Not one. Out of 12. Fournier blinks rapidly, several times. "A mistake, presumably. Inert samples." He is thinking it through, even as he speaks. "No. They would have been cultured separately, grown in different media. But then, that would mean..." "Exactly," Carlyle nods. "An environmental inhibitor for the hungry plague. Something unique about the Cairngorm Plateau, at least at its higher end. Altitude? Air pressure? Electromagnetic fields? You'd be able to come up with a better guess than me, Doctor, I'm sure. Or perhaps it's nothing. Perhaps, as you suggested, the cultures were dead before they were put into the jars. Contaminated in some way. We've decided, though, to take the chance. To assume that it's not a mistake." "We?" Fournier echoes with just a hint of a sneer. "Your crew is gone, Colonel." "I know," Carlyle says. "But they haven't gone far. They've probably arrived at Beacon before we reached London. They'll spread the word as discreetly as they can that there's an alternative now. Another choice. Beacon is becoming a terrible place, poisoned by its own isolation. Anyone who wants to leave and try again is welcome to come with us." "To Scotland?" Fournier is incredulous. "To the Cairngorms?" "Yes." "You won't last the first winter, assuming you even get there in the first place." "Possibly not, but I believe it's worthwhile making the attempt. It gives me hope, and hope is important." Carlyle points out of the window again. When Fournier turns to look, he puts the gun against the side of the doctor's head and pulls the trigger. He is almost certain that Fournier didn't see it coming. As much mercy as he could manage in the circumstances. Certainly a better death than the doctor would find for himself, if he were left to walk home. There is nowhere nearby to bury the body, and Carlyle has no tools that would serve. In any case, it seems to him, Rosie does very well as a coffin, and London does tolerably well as a mausoleum. He inflicts as much damage on the engine as he can bear to. He doesn't want Rosie ever to move again, ever to fight and kill again. But vandalism doesn't come easy to him. He has a very long way to travel. He packs a rucksack with rations for a week or two, Eadlocker for a month. If it takes longer than that, then he probably won't make it at all. But he will. He will make it. And Foss and Sixsmith and McQueen will join him there, presently, with anyone from Beacon who has heard their message, that the fireman is waiting for them, high up in the snows and the frigid air, that he will build a new city with their help, or die trying. He exits through the airlock, setting it to seal itself behind him. He sets off walking. It's a beautiful evening, a beautiful place. He pretends as he walks that the old world never fell, that when he turns the corner he will see traffic roaring by, foreign tourists waving selfie sticks like bishops' croziers, office workers walking briskly from their hectic work to their hectic leisure. And street upon street, the city. And city upon city, the world. Uncountable millions of people, as it was before. He imagines that history stretches before him as well as behind, a river so broad and deep it makes the Thames look like nothing more than a teardrop rolling down the world's rugged cheek. Epilogue. 20 years later. The snow is 8 inches deep, but you wouldn't want to trust to that too much. This is glacial moraine, sown through and through with rifts and fissures, into which snow has drifted until they've filled to the brim. If you don't test every step before you take it, you can sink into a hollow that's deeper than your height, with rocks as sharp as teeth at the bottom of it. Nonetheless, the little group of figures down on the eastern slope is making steady progress. They tack left and right, all together, and they keep on coming. There are places on the slope that are still in shadow, the blood-tinged dawnlight poking patchily through the peaks above. But the 6 men and women don't slow down to probe the blank expanses ahead of them, and they don't put a foot wrong. Foss is struck as she watches them come by. How young they look, the oldest barely 30. That's not the most striking thing about them, though. What she noticed first, and can't keep from thinking about, is how lightly they're dressed. Short jackets, open to the biting wind, no hats. If they were human, normal, baseline human, 1.0 human, they'd be dead. So they're what the Colonel said they had to be when they were first sighted at the edge of the plateau. They're hungries. And there are more of them down at the bottom of the slope, half a mile back. This is just the vanguard. Foss turns and walks back the way she came, up to the top of the slope, and then north along the razor edge of what used to be called the Larigrew Pass. There are 3 sentries stationed in the rocks above the pass. They can see Foss as she comes, and they can see each other. She raises her rifle horizontally and holds it in the air for several seconds in her left hand. It's a prearranged signal that means, hold your positions and do nothing unless directly attacked. The sentries, who have been straining every nerve since she went down slope, relax a little and return to their vigil. They have enough discipline not to shout questions at her as she walks on by. Around the shoulder of the mountain, above the swollen exclamation point that is Loch Etchachan, is a settlement made of 90 tents and 37 wooden huts, sprawling, ragged and dirty, surrounded by mounds of its own rubbish that will stay on the mountain until the spring thaw makes it safe to take them down to the sinkhole below the pass that is the settlement's official waste disposal. On an ordinary day, even this early in the morning, there would be people walking or running across the open ground between the tents, children on their way to school, men and women coming back from a hunt, or from the barns along the line of the pass with sacks of turnips or onions on their backs. But this isn't an ordinary day. A few more of Foss's people stand on guard at their posts on the upslope and at the ends of the tent avenues. Everyone else is 3 miles down the pass, hidden in a defile whose mouth has been painstakingly camouflaged, ready to retreat up or down the mountain depending on which signal flare they see. Foss goes to the council hut, where the colonel sits alone and makes her report. Carlyle gets to his feet. It's not a quick or easy process these days. The years have not been kind to his old injury, or more generally to his hips and lower back. Foss has to resist the urge to give the frail old man a hand up, knowing that the reminder of his weakness shames him. "We'll go down to them," he says. "Okay," Foss agrees. "But I'll lead, Isaac. You don't have to come." "Yes," he tells her. "I do." So it takes a good long time for them to get out onto the moraine, and after that they slow down more than somewhat. Foss could wish that the colonel had left this in her hands, though she knows why he hasn't. The people who left Beacon to found this precarious community put their trust in his name and reputation. He carries that responsibility like a physical weight. All the same, she would have preferred for them to make their stand further down the plateau, if only because it will give the rest of the good citizens of Rosie's town more of a head start if the balloon goes up. 100 yards down from the northeastern edge of the moraine, there is a rock shaped a little bit like a squatting rabbit. A small burn cuts in front of its base. McQueen is waiting for them there, and he gives them a nod of greeting as they come up. "They're almost here," he says with a sidelong flick of his gaze. "I've wired the rock with C4 in a couple of places, so we can throw them a decent party if we have to. This is a good enough place to wait." Foss agrees. The sentries above will be able to see them clearly, so she doesn't have to worry about getting the signal out. They space themselves out to either side of the colonel, rifles at parade rest, while their visitors climb the last few 100 yards up the slope. When McQueen judges that they're close enough, he waves them to a halt. They understand his gesture and they obey it, which has to count as a good start. Nobody's ripping anyone's throat out, or at least not yet a while. "So young," Foss thinks again, "and weirdly so beautiful. The whites of their eyes are cordyceps grey, but their skin is perfect, not dried out and broken with frost, scaly from vitamin B deficiency or ridged with keloid scars. They even look a little tanned, which suggests they may have started their journey a long way further south. That's not true of their leader, though. She's white blonde and albino pale, her skin utterly without pigment. Her age is difficult to guess, but she's certainly not the oldest here. She carries herself with an unself-conscious grace, without arrogance, almost without emphasis. Her short-sleeved shirt, it must be 20 below, is a plain lemon yellow, and her trousers, muddy, threadbare, are tucked into battered, well-worn boots. She wears no badge of office, but when she stands forward, the others drop back, deferential, attentive, completely silent. "I'm Melanie," she says. "Good morning to you all." In polished English, beautifully enunciated, Foss's scalp prickles. What she has expected, up to now, is a sort of pantomime of grimaces and gesticulations. It never occurred to her that the second-gen Hungries would have learned a language, or that if they did, it would be this one. "Isaac Carlyle," the colonel says. "Colonel Isaac Carlyle," Foss corrects. "And that is Cat Foss, while to my right is Daniel McQueen." The woman looks at each of them in turn, takes time to assess them. It's a close enough examination that Foss tenses a little and starts to measure distances and angles. If Snow White here wants to start something, they'll meet her halfway. "We've been looking for you for a long time, Colonel Carlyle," the woman says. Carlyle says nothing, but McQueen rises to the bait, and Foss is not surprised.
"Really?"
he says. "And why is that?" The woman, Melanie, holds her arms out from her sides, palms open. "We didn't think there were any of you left," she says. "It seemed too much to hope for. But we didn't want to give up the search while there was still a chance." Is it Foss's imagination, or did one of the guys further back just lick his lips?
There are plenty of us left, she says, up here and in lots of other places besides.
No. The word is flat, unemphatic. Melanie shakes her head. The world is poison to you now. Apart from this one place, apparently. Beacon and the Junker tribes died out at the same time, and then there was just us. Or so we thought.
That's a cute little euphemism, McQueen observes. Died out. You mean they were eaten, right?
No. Melanie looks cast down for a moment, guilty almost. The Cordyceps pathogen became airborne. All humans everywhere became hungries all at once, except for you.
Foss is stunned by the words, not because they come as a surprise. Nobody who has left the mountain has ever come back in more than a decade, or else they came back changed, rabid, whether they had bite marks on them or not. It's been plain for a long time that the plateau is an island in an invisible but toxic ocean. But still, to hear it said fills her, in a few moments, with a decade's worth of fear and grieving. It's one thing to be in exile and another thing to know it. She hadn't even realized she was lying to herself until she feels the tears freezing on her cheeks.
"Then how did you know to look for us?" Carlyle demands. Mild, not confrontational, not acknowledging the hopelessness of their position.
Melanie's face creases with earnestness. "We didn't," she says. "I told you. It was just that we wanted to do everything we could before we finally, officially, gave up the search. Some friends of mine looked at old records from before the breakdown, and drew up a list of places where extreme weather patterns or unusual microclimates might offer some..." She chooses the word with care. "Protection for you. I've had teams searching those areas for years now, whenever they could be spared from other work. And finally, last year, they found you. Everyone was really excited when they brought the news back."
"Yeah," McQueen says, deadpan. "I bet. Nothing like varying the menu."
Melanie's five companions bridle at this. They try to keep up their expressions of disciplined impassivity, but anger shows itself momentarily, here and there, in the twitch of a mouth or the narrowing of an eye, like small sparks struck off grey stone. One of the five clenches his fists, then slowly relaxes them again as Melanie goes on in the same, even tone.
"We didn't announce ourselves at once, because we wanted to be sure we understood your situation. We've been watching from a distance, as discreetly as we could, building up a picture."
"And do you," Carlyle asks, "understand our situation?"
"I think so," Melanie says. "Yes."
Once again she looks at all three of them in turn, as though she's aware these words might hurt and is solicitous of their feelings.
"You're weak, barely surviving. This is hard land to live in, and even harder land to farm. Your harvest a few weeks ago was the worst since you arrived here. You don't have enough food left to see more than half of you through to next spring. Plus, I'd imagine you're starting to see cases of scurvy and rickets, because there isn't enough fruit or calcium in your diet. So even if you survive the winter, you're going to be in an even worse position going forward. Probably your colony has 2 or maybe 3 years left. Maybe not so long."
She stops speaking, and dead silence follows. Foss exchanges a glance with McQueen, and she's happy to read in his face that they're on the same page. They'll let the colonel take the lead on this one, and they know exactly what he's going to say. He draws in a long breath and lets it out again, steadying himself, finding words that are equal to the moment.
"You won't take us easily," he says, "or without great cost to yourselves."
Melanie tries to break in, but he goes on, speaking over her.
"I won't bother to deny what you've seen with your own eyes. Yes, we're weak. Our bodies are. But trust me when I tell you that the people who came here were the strongest Beacon had to offer. They walked 400 miles for the bare chance of a new life. They'll do more for the chance to keep it.
Melanie seems flustered, dismayed.
But, she says, Colonel.
So come when you're ready, Carlyle invites her. You'll find us ready too.
Colonel, we came here to help you.
Carlyle is already turning away as she speaks. He's caught there, on the cusp of the movement. Melanie laughs in pure embarrassment, as if she can't believe they were coming at this conversation from such different angles, that things she took as given still needed to be said. Someone has to play the straight man. Foss finds it's her.
What are you talking about? She inquires.
Melanie points off down the slope. The rest of her underdressed entourage have advanced a little, and now they're setting down boxes and crates in a rough and ready cairn.
Food, she says, and medicines. The plastic coolers are full of rabbits, freshly caught as we came up. The wooden crates are apples and greengages. You can eat those, yes?
Greengages, McQueen says. It's hard to read his tone, but Foss's mouth has filled with saliva just on hearing the word.
We thought fresh fruit and protein would be your most pressing needs, Melanie says.
The rest is negotiable. We don't cultivate grain for ourselves, obviously, but we can grow it for you. You'll tell us what you need. What we don't have, we'll find or make.
They're speechless for a moment or two. Then the Colonel, who is still standing half-turned away from the girl, asks her the question that's uppermost in all their minds.
Why?
Melanie doesn't seem to understand, so he asks again.
Why would you do this?
Because we can, she says.
She seems genuinely puzzled by the question.
Because we thought you were all gone, and were so happy that we were wrong. That your people and my people can meet and talk and learn from each other. You'd just have been legends to us otherwise.
She smiles, as though that thought strikes her as funny.
I know how legends work. In a few generations there'd be 1,000 wild stories about you and the truth. Well, the truth would just be a story a little less interesting than the rest. Now that we've found you, we'll keep looking. Not just up here in Scotland, but elsewhere in the world. We've already started to equip an expedition to France and Switzerland. I mean to the places that used to be France and Switzerland. You might not be the only ones after all.
The crates and boxes are still piling up at the bottom of the slope. It's starting to look as though there might even be enough to make a difference.
Thank you, the Colonel says, with awkward formality. We appreciate your offer of assistance.
You're very welcome, Colonel Carlyle. But we need to ask a favour in return.
Here it comes, Foss thinks. The catch. There was bound to be one. You're old, you're sick, you're criminally insane. Who do they think will be prepared to throw into the lunch basket?
We're bringing you something else,
Melanie says. And this time her smile is wider. There's definitely a joke they're not getting.
Someone else, I should say. And we want you to make her at home. We want that very much. She's been on her own for a long time.
The sound of an engine reaches them on the thin, clear air. It's coming from the road below the ridge, still hidden from sight by a frozen tide of drifted snow. And it's been 20 years. But Foss would know that basso roar anywhere.
Oh, my sweet Jesus, she exclaims. Oh, no fucking way!
Rosie crests the ridge like a ship cresting the horizon, with a stranger at the wheel. A dark-skinned woman in torn and faded fatigues, grimacing with effort as she urges the vehicle's unwieldy mass slantwise up the sliding scree. It seems to Foss in the lightness and strangeness of that moment, as though the past has swung open in front of her like a door. She never stopped being a part of that crew. Rosie is coming to collect her for another tour of duty, one last mission in country. and something like relief floods through her at the sight of it. Something like joy.